You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, some communities across the United States are experiencing a sharp decline in the number of volunteer firefighters. We'll find out why that's happening, what it means, and what's being done to bring those numbers back up. First, one person was killed and three wounded at a San Diego synagogue on Saturday, the last day of Passover. Authorities are looking at the suspect's social media posts and investigating whether he's connected to an arson at a nearby mosque. The rabbi of the synagogue, Yisrael Goldstein, told reporters yesterday what he said to his congregation after the attack.
We are a Jewish nation that will stand tall. We will not let anyone or anything take us down. Terrorism like this will not take us down.
The shooting was the latest act of violence against a place of worship, a string that includes bombings of Christian churches in Sri Lanka on Easter, mass shootings at two mosques in New Zealand, and another shooting at a Pittsburgh synagogue last fall. Now, religious centers are trying to strike a balance between being open and inviting and secure. Wayne Thompson is an associate professor of sociology and criminal justice at Carthage College in Kenosha. He specializes in the social dimensions of religion and crime. Wayne, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be on the show.
Well, we see a lot of these attacks in the news. Wayne, are we seeing an increasing number of acts of violence against congregations?
Unfortunately, Rob, we have seen an increase. It's been noted by the Anti-Defamation League for Jews and also by the FBI. There's an uptick in hate crimes since 2013. Mostly due to attacks on religious and racial and ethnic minorities.
We'll get into why that might be in a little bit, Wayne, but I want to talk about how congregations respond as well. And it's a bitter irony. These are places that are supposed to be open. They're community-oriented. They're places where people hope to feel safe, and yet they're confronting these issues of safety and security. How do you see congregations from different religious backgrounds trying to struggle with that contradiction?
Well, some congregations are more at risk. Immigrant congregations where people are outside of the mainstream religious traditions are especially targets. They're visible in the community. Sometimes that leads to mistaken identity, as in the attack on the Sikhs in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, just a few years ago. No, it was interesting, Rob, how that congregation in Oak Creek responded. Mm-hmm. Several people were killed. The guru was killed during the attack. And the response was that lots of folks in the community, other religious faith communities, reached out to the Sikh community in Oak Creek and forged partnerships, friendships. And also the Sikh community looked at becoming more public, you know, more mainstreamed. And they in religious dialogue and with other faith communities in the Milwaukee area. So that was an unintended consequence of a terrible tragedy.
Now, why are we seeing places of worship targeted?
Well,
I think we've lost Wayne Thompson. We'll reconnect with him. Wayne Thompson is an associate professor of sociology and criminal justice at Carthage College in Kenosha. He specializes in the social dimensions of religion and crime. We're looking at acts of violence targeting places of worship. Sadly, it's happened here in Wisconsin, around the United States, and around the world to different religious groups and different denominations, looking at the causes behind that. And we'll talk a little more about how faith organizations respond. A Wisconsin company that provides insurance coverage to many places of worship around the country. We'll hear from them with their perspective on how they help congregations deal with these issues. Now, Wayne, let's talk about why you see places of worship being targeted by people who want to commit these horrible acts of violence.
Sure, Rob. Well, when you dress differently, you look differently, you believe differently, you worship differently, and in a highly concentrated community, often set apart from the mainstream community, it's easy to understand why they would become a target. Also, there are groups that motivate religious violence for religious or political reasons and will identify a clear enemy. So that's a recipe for these violent attacks. there may be psychopathology involved. In other words, there may be, you know, mental or emotional stability on the part of the people doing the attacks. But oftentimes there's a social network, social media, and other kinds of support system motivating this violence.
Do you see a copycat element in some attacks on mosques and synagogues? We've seen people pointing to previous attacks by white nationalists. On the other hand, we also see people referring to the attacks on churches in Sri Lanka as a response to attacks on mosques. Either way, there's a sort of contagion.
Yes. Well, the attack in Sri Lanka is possibly connected to, as you pointed out, to the attack on mosques in March in New Zealand. So there can be that kind of tit-for-tat response. But also just the visibility of these communities and the nature of, you know, being set aside, being different, is going to make them, you know, easy targets in many ways. And plus, with the nature of how religious calendars work, that everybody's coming together at one place, at one time, in a highly visible way. A good way to get across a kind of identity politics, white nationalism often is the motivation here.
It seems like there's two basic reactions people could have, an us-against-them reaction. They've attacked us. Maybe we need to retaliate or secure ourselves from them. But you also mentioned, after the Sikh temple shooting here in Wisconsin, and this is common around the world after attacks like these, people from different faiths banding together, seeing how they can reach across those boundaries. What makes us go one way or the other?
Well, I think the groups that are religious faith communities that are closer to the mainstream, that are closer to being associated with central institutions in a society, have more vested interest in keeping social peace. Under conditions of cultural pluralism like we have in the United States, that places a kind of heavy burden on the, if you will, the tall steeple churches, the mainline Jewish and Christian organizations that reach out to the more marginalized religious communities. So it depends on, you know, your centrality in the community. Other marginal communities are less likely to respond in this positive way than the mainstream communities that are often united, like ministerial associations. That was an important factor in Milwaukee when there were vehicles already in place for interfaith dialogue in the community. It's just that it hadn't reached the Sikh community until this terrible tragedy happened.
Do you have thoughts on how faith leaders can build those bonds across denominations, across faiths, hopefully before and apart from a tragic incident like the ones we're talking about?
Well, you know, that you could talk about interfaith dialogue is the way that theologians talk about this. And indeed, at the small liberal arts college, Carthage College, where I teach in Kenosha, we had an interfaith dialogue event a few years ago, which was Christian-Muslim dialogue. And so having those kinds of events that are very public, inviting the community, having people meet each other on an equal footing, in situations that are about conflict resolution and about reducing tensions, often have a very positive impact. But you need an infrastructure for doing that. Milwaukee had that infrastructure and was able to take advantage of it.
We're talking about the increase in violence at places of worship around the world. Wayne Thompson is with us, Associate Professor of Sociology and Criminal Justice at Carthage College in Kenosha. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's on your mind as you see these attacks on synagogues, churches, mosques, temples, and other religious centers? Do you worry about this at your own place of worship? And has your house of worship done something or talked about doing something geared toward increasing security? How does that affect the attitude maybe of openness that you wanted to your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the recent string of violence at houses of worship. One person was killed and three injured at a synagogue near San Diego this weekend. Before that, we saw these attacks on Christian churches in Sri Lanka, a mosque in New Zealand. Last fall, a mass shooting in a synagogue in Pittsburgh. shootings at African-American churches in the United States, and more. Wayne Thompson is with us, Associate Professor of Sociology and Criminal Justice at Carthage College in Kenosha. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something you think about, maybe worry about at your own place of worship? And have you seen more security, something to hopefully head off a threat at the place you worship? Or do you worry that that's going to send a bad message, make your congregation a little less open? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to bring in a new voice to the conversation now. Guy Russ is the Assistant Vice President of Risk Control at Church Mutual, an insurance company for religious centers and other institutions. They're based in Merrill, Wisconsin. He's part of the team that coordinates trainings around the country to help places of worship deal with threats of violence. Guy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, thank you, Rob.
Well, it's unfortunate that we have to have these kind of conversations, but when you talk to congregations around the country, what kind of things do you point to when it comes to security?
We try to help them understand that there are things they can do to prevent these acts of violence, as well as if they do occur, to respond to them, with the most important thing being having a plan and then practicing that plan.
So something like we see in schools with the active shooter trainings?
Absolutely. In fact, we partner with an organization called the Alice Training Institute, and they got their start in the school markets.
And are there things congregations can do to watch for warning signs? And it seems like a lot of these attacks, when they happen, they kind of come out of nowhere. But are there things that maybe places of worship should think about to try to anticipate these things?
Yes, actually, the FBI research on these incidents shows that more often than not, the attackers are signaling that they are thinking of committing violence at a particular location. There are services that are available to monitor organizations or the names of organizations through social media and other areas to find out if their organization is being mentioned in some sort of a post that might indicate somebody is thinking about doing violence at their location.
Guy, do you get reactions from faith leaders saying, you know, these kind of things, security trainings, they're kind of contrary to their mission as a peaceful community institution?
It is a tough thing for houses of worship to strike the right balance between being open and welcoming people into their ministries and their missions, but also keeping people safe while they're there. That's part of the purpose of the events that we run, is to help people think through those questions prior to something like this happening.
So if there is a leader of a congregation out there listening, or maybe somebody on a board, what kind of recommendations would you have for them? Hopefully this will never happen where they worship, but what kind of recommendations would you have for them to be prepared now?
Right, absolutely. The plan is the biggest part of preparing, sitting down and having a conversation in their organization to decide what type of balance they want to strike between being open and being safe, and then constructing a plan consistent with that decision, and then practicing that plan often.
Guy, thanks a lot for taking some time today. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you, Rob.
That's Guy Russ, Assistant Vice President of Risk Control at Church Mutual, based in Merrill, Wisconsin. They're a company that insures a lot of institutions, including many religious centers. He was with us to talk about how they advise their clients on how to get ready for and deal with threats of violence. Wayne Thompson, let's bring you back into this now. You've worked with and consulted, I know, with different religious organizations over your career. Is this an issue people want to be thinking about, that they're taking head on right now?
Well, in the sense of being proactive and reaching out and partnering with other faith communities who have been under attack and under siege and showing solidarity, it is indeed a major priority for mainline Protestants. Evangelical Protestants often have spoken out against these kind of violent incidents, but they're not as organized to reach out. They're more insular within their community. So I would say, you know, Catholics, Jews, and mainline Protestants are the ones mostly having these kinds of discussions and doing this reaching out to each other in the communities.
That's an interesting point, because places of worship, they operate very differently from one global hierarchy bringing all, say, Catholic churches together to what we might think of as a denomination, but each center really calls its own shots, if you will. Are there common rules, do you think, that can apply to such a wide diversity of religious organizations when it comes to thinking about potential violence?
Well, it depends on visibility, types of communities, access. those sorts of things. The safest end of the continuum are probably, you know, rural mainline white churches and in homogenous communities, whereas in more culturally pluralistic environments like large cities, where there are more immigrants, more differences, the religious differences themselves become, you know, an object for conflict. And so I would think, you know, urban areas versus rural areas, also regions of the country, you see much less of this kind of violence in small-town and rural upper Midwest communities than you would in large population centers in the East and in the South, where there is noted to be more of a culture of violence in general. So where you are in the country and where you are in the urban to rural spectrum makes a big difference in terms of vulnerability.
Talking to Wayne Thompson, Associate Professor of Sociology and Criminal Justice at Carthage College in Kenosha, talking about shootings at places of worship around the country, around the world, how congregations can react to them. You can still join in at 800-642-1234 if this has been an issue at your own place of worship, 800-642-1234. Wayne, let's get back to some of the causes and maybe ways to prevent these acts of violence. You mentioned the social media connections, the outreach from anything from a white supremacist group to a group like ISIS in trying to recruit the next shooter. Are there things that you can see that might be effective at preventing that kind of outreach being successful?
Well, with social media being unregulated the way it is, it's really unlikely that the kinds of social networks that are supportive of intergroup conflict, that is, you know, high tension groups, those kinds of conditions are going to be there on social media. I think that local community, you know, religion's like politics, Rob. It's everything's really local, in a sense. So it really is a matter of reaching out across town, across the racial divides that are clearly evident in churches, in religious groups, and the ethnic divides, and so on. You have to do that on a local level. Here in Kenosha, we have a mosque where the folks there at the mosque felt, you know, very isolated. They started to reach out to the mainstream ministerial associations and so on, and the groups. My church, for instance, Mercine, reached out and were able to go and do like a Islam 101 night over at the mosque. Those kinds of things happen on the local level. It's very difficult because to make generalizations because every community is different, relationships are different, and the amount of diversity in the community is a factor.
Now, some research I've seen points to the idea that people who commit acts of violence like this in the name of a religion directed at members of another religion often aren't the people who grew up in the faith or are closely attached to the faith. They might be the recent convert or a disaffected person who's kind of on the fringes. You might not reach them at the mainstream church or the mainstream mosque or whatever it might be. Lone wolf is the word often thrown around. How can we do outreach to people who may not be at the table to begin with?
Yeah, it's very difficult when you have people sitting out in, you know, an isolated trailer out in the country side and you know, connecting to the support of social networks via internet, then you do have this lone wolf phenomenon that is kind of a North American cultural issue, right? In terms of our way of life, it's kind of like an up goes the garage door, down comes the garage door, suburban culture where we're not as well connected. The connections that many of these people do have to right-wing hate groups is kind of tenuous. You know, they're often not deeply integrated into the social networks, but they do get exposed to the ideology and some of the relationships via social media. Very difficult to control because it's so diffuse.
I want to take a long view here, Wayne. Thinking back a few centuries in Europe, the idea that Protestants and Catholics could live within the same borders and not kill each other was absurd. It was a ridiculous idea to many people. Here we are today, not so crazy. As bad as things look right now sometimes between, say, Muslims and Christians, for example, or any throw in whatever groups you want there, do you see reason for hope that in the decades, century to come, we will overcome those differences as we did the Catholic-Protestant divide?
Well, I think indeed that the long arc of history does bend toward tolerance and also religious tolerance. I think about tensions in Northern Ireland when I was growing up in the 1960s and 70s. We've made great strides in that regard. And I often think in this context about Gandhi, the leader in India after World War II, who was asked if he's a Hindu. He said, yeah, I'm a Hindu at 8 in the morning. By 10 in the morning, I'm a Muslim and Christian in the afternoon and an atheist when that makes sense. Those kinds of more cosmopolitan worldviews and religious tolerance come with intergroup contact, with urbanization, with the kinds of factors that are demographically driven and inevitable. I think religious tolerance is on the long arc horizon.
As we wrap up, what would you like to hear from political leaders in our nation and others that might help put out some of the fires that that lead to intolerance and ultimately these kinds of attacks on houses of worship?
Well, it's important that religious leaders speak out, and I think we've seen that. Also that political leaders and other kinds of leaders, education and business, speak out across the society condemning religious violence and hatred and hate groups, and having a consistent message. I think President Trump struck a reasonable, chord and set of platitudes and so on when he reacted when he was at the Green Bay rally. But it's important to be consistent about that message and not also provide kind of encouragement for intergroup tensions. So you have to provide a consistent message of peace across politics, religion, and other institutions.
Wayne, thanks a lot for joining us.
It was a pleasure, Rob.
That's Wayne Thompson, Associate Professor of Sociology and Criminal Justice at Carthage College in Kenosha. He specializes in the social dimensions of religion and crime. We talked with him about what's driving the recent violence at places of worship around the world. We also heard from Guy Ross of the insurance company Church Mutual about ways religious institutions can prepare for violent incidents should they happen in the future. Coming up, many fire departments used to have waiting lists for people wanting to be volunteer firefighters. Now there are too few volunteers. We'll talk about what's behind the dwindling numbers and what communities around the state and nation are trying to do about it. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at unsolved crimes and how they affect the communities hoping for answers. That's tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show. Now, some fire departments around the country are grappling with a problem that in some cases is causing them to take drastic measures. Too few volunteers. A few decades ago, it wasn't unusual for departments to have waiting lists for volunteer firefighters, people who wanted to sign up. Those days appear to be over, at least for now. In North Carolina, for example, the Federal Emergency Management Agency said the number of volunteers fell by 1,200 over 2 years, about a 22% decline. As a result of the shortage, some departments are cutting services, shutting down, trying to figure out how to afford full-time firefighters. So what's going on and what's being done to bring in more recruits? Catherine Barrett is a columnist and correspondent for Governing Magazine. She researches and writes about state and local government, and she recently wrote about the volunteer firefighter shortage. Catherine, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much, Rob.
Well, for some people in especially bigger cities, this might not be a familiar problem, but I know a lot of communities around Wisconsin and elsewhere have volunteer firefighters. How common is it for communities to rely, at least in part, on volunteers?
It's really common. This kind of surprised me, but 65% of firefighters in the country are volunteers. It used to be 70%, and the number is really dropping.
And as part of your reporting, you looked at what volunteer firefighters do. I'm sure it varies from place to place, but talk about what their schedule is being on call, what they're expected to do as volunteer firefighters.
They're expected to do quite a lot, they're often on call during the evenings. It's hard work. I think it's very satisfying, but fire departments are having a much harder time keeping their volunteers. So retention is a big issue, and people just live a bit differently than they used to, and it's hard for people to devote the time that that volunteer firefighters did, you know, 20 or 30 years ago.
And often they're volunteer firefighters. There's often a little bit of money involved. It's not a lot of money, though, for someone being that volunteer, right?
Yeah, and that really differs around the country. Some places have tried to deal with their shortage by offering different kinds of incentives, like a cut in property taxes, a cut in income taxes, in some cases a very small stipend, or you know, if you serve for 25 years, a small pension. But a lot of people don't do that. I mean, a lot of places don't do that. It's a really tough issue right now.
Talking to Catherine Barrett from Governing Magazine about volunteer firefighters around the country. There is a shortage of them in many communities. A Pennsylvania Fire and Emergency Services Institute report concluded that with the continuing loss of volunteers, taxpayers could end up paying a lot more money. Can you talk about the fiscal impact and what's happening as communities realize maybe they have no option but to go with full-time professional firefighters?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a problem especially hitting areas with a lot of small towns, rural areas, and that's certainly the case in Pennsylvania, where there are, you know, many, many, many different little communities. There was a study done in Pennsylvania last year, and they estimated that if you had to replace all of the volunteer firefighters with professionals, it could cost the state $10 billion a year. I mean, this is an enormous number and a really heavy burden for taxpayers. So they're trying to figure out what to do. They're trying to, you know, think of adding some of the incentives that places like Maryland add, like a break on some kind of break on taxes.
Catherine, you mentioned earlier that we live differently now. What are some of the things that either fire chiefs or you talk to some volunteers themselves, what are some of the things they talked about that make volunteer firefighting just not fit with their daily lives?
Yeah, you know, we interviewed a fire chief in Cherryville, North Carolina, and he told a very poignant story about his community. 25 years ago, there were 11 textile plants, one big, you know, trucking company. There was a lot of local employment, and every single one of those textile plants closed down. The trucking company left, and now people who live in that community have to commute sometimes to Charlotte, which is 40 miles away. It makes it much more difficult to volunteer in the community. Also, when there were you know, jobs to be had and big businesses in that small town, the businesses would let people, the volunteer firefighters, go off if they had an emergency call. That's not the case anymore because the employers in that town are small employers. They're mom-and-pop shops now.
I talked to, this has been a while back, I talked to a former professional firefighter in the Wausau, Wisconsin area, and he talked about how the job has changed. Some of it is putting out the fires, and some of it is calls for things like a Narcan for overdoses. Is the nature of the job changing for volunteer firefighters, too, to maybe something they hadn't really thought about when they came in?
Yeah, I think that is a factor. There are fewer big fires. That's a good thing. But firefighters or people who are called firefighters are now spending a good deal of their time responding to car accidents or hazardous material spills or just plain medical calls. Somebody said to us, it's just not quite the same to go help, an older woman who has fallen down than to go to a fire where there's kind of an adrenaline rush. All of the calls that they get are very important calls, but it's not always the image that young volunteers have of what firefighting will be.
What did you see from the communities you looked at when it comes to trying to turn these numbers around and recruit more volunteer firefighters?
Yeah, we were really very interested in what was happening in Maryland, and one of the communities there was working very hard at changing the culture of the firehouses, and so that they would feel welcoming to a different set of volunteers, that it can't all be, you know, white males, particularly in that county, Montgomery County. It's a very diverse community, and so they are doing a lot to bring women in as volunteers, a lot to bring, it's a very diverse culture, so bringing people from other countries in as volunteers. One of their trainers comes from Guatemala and, you know, speaks four different languages. The other thing that they're really trying to do is create a very family-like atmosphere, that it's a community. I know that they were talking to me about, you know, when they bring people in for training, they serve dinner, everybody eats together. They want it to be a place where people feel very good about volunteering.
We're talking about the declining numbers of volunteer firefighters around the nation and what communities are trying to do to reverse that trend. Catherine Barrett is our guest. She's a columnist and correspondent for Governing Magazine. She's written about this issue. Just a few moments, we'll hear what's going on here in Wisconsin. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you done this? Are you doing this? Are you a volunteer firefighter or EMT? I know a lot of communities around the state rely on volunteer EMTs. What got you into it? Why do you keep doing it? Or do you find that being a volunteer just doesn't fit with the realities of your life, being on call for long periods of time while you're trying to do your own job at the same time? And if you lead a fire department, love to hear from you as well. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the declining numbers of volunteer firefighters around the United States. Catherine Barrett is with us from Governing Magazine. She wrote about this issue. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you now or have you ever been a volunteer firefighter or EMT? Love to hear about your experiences, what the job was like, why you do it, why you did it, why you stopped. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now for a sense of what's going on with volunteer firefighting here in Wisconsin, let's go to Nate Melby. He's president of the Wisconsin State Fire Chiefs Association and the volunteer chief of the town of Campbell Fire Department near La Crosse. Nate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've been hearing what's going on around the country. Are we seeing departments in Wisconsin having trouble keeping up the numbers of volunteer firefighters?
Well, I think, you know, it is a national trend, and we see in Wisconsin's own way some of those challenges being represented here, too. You know, one of the things that we look at as an association is that the Wisconsin Fire Service is about 80% volunteer compared to the National Fire Service at around 70% volunteers. So we have more volunteers in Wisconsin, and sometimes those trends we see magnified in certain ways, and in other ways we see our volunteer service as stronger because we have a larger mass of volunteer departments here.
Is there a strong tradition here in Wisconsin that maybe helps get the word out more, maybe where it wouldn't be in another state?
I think there is to some degree. You know, the volunteer fire service is really largely rural and born of the rural communities. And so I think due to Wisconsin's rural nature, we see strength in the volunteer service in those areas. But, you know, there are changing demographics that we're kind of embattled with. We look at the change in the rural communities and how we see, you know, younger families maybe leaving rural communities for more urban amenities or urban communities. And so those were all potential firefighters that we may have been able to tap into in the past where they won't be there for us in the future.
Yeah, we heard from James on Facebook who says, hey, there are low numbers of young people living in rural areas that rely on volunteer firefighters, backing up what you just said there. So how does your department, how do other departments try to reach out, get the word out, and recruit the young people who are there?
Sure. So, you know, some of the things that I've seen departments do is they continue to try to get increasingly creative. You know, one of the strengths of the American Fire Service is the ingenuity. It's the Swiss Army knife of medical or of emergency services. And so you'll see different solutions depending on what the local challenges are. I've seen departments do things like starting some type of a child care program so firefighters can respond to calls at different stages of life if they have young families, trying to provide for somebody to watch their kids so that they can respond. I've seen things where they are, you know, incentivized with, you know, length of service plans, We're even working in the state of Wisconsin with our legislators to try to provide some tax incentives to volunteer firefighters so that we can retain them longer. Once people join the fire department and go through the training, they're very valuable to the fire department community. And the longer you can keep them after they're trained, the better it is for everyone.
Now, Nate, you're a volunteer chief yourself. You've obviously worked with a lot of volunteer firefighters. Again, obviously, none of you are doing it for the money. Can you talk about the motivation? What is it that, motivates you as you go on to that next 24-hour shift on call?
Sure. So, I've been asked that question many times during my career in the fire service, and the best answer that I can give you is it's about a sense of duty. It's kind of a scary thought as a firefighter to think, what would happen if there were a fire or someone needed our services and we weren't there? And so, there are certain people in every community that say, okay, I'm doing this and that's our responsibility and we're going to take that on. But for those of us that are doing that and we see, the generations that have come before us and them taking the mantle, well, there's another generation here that now it's another generation's turn. And it's a generation that's facing different challenges with the way they spend their time and their availability and the other demands on their lives and everything else. So it's a whole different game now.
And Nate, as we wrap up, if there's somebody out there listening thinking, I don't even know you could volunteer and be a firefighter, maybe I could, I don't know, what would you tell them about how to check it out and how to get involved?
Sure. One of the things I would say is it's one of the best things that you can do. It's one of the best ways you can spend your time. You can directly impact and help other people if you join the volunteer fire service. If you're interested in it, go to your local volunteer department and just ask about it. I'm sure that any training night they would welcome you in and be happy to talk to you about it and what it takes. The other thing that I would say is don't feel that it's just being limited to someone who wants to fight fires or somebody that wants to go on medical calls and be an EMT. Fire departments that are becoming more creative are finding all sorts of new roles. One of the roles my department created was an administrative position. We had a volunteer that was very good at record keeping and data entry, and so we created what we call a fire corps position, which is a non-operational position, but they're still a member of our organization, and they can contribute in their own way.
Nate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Nate Melby, president of the Wisconsin State Fire Chiefs Association and the volunteer chief of the town of Campbell Fire Department. We're talking about departments, communities around the nation having trouble keeping enough volunteer firefighters on the job. Let's go back now to Catherine Barrett from Governing Magazine, who's been reporting on this. We heard from Nate Melby there, Catherine, about getting the word out. And that's something you found in your reporting, that departments were just having to get the publicity out there that, hey, we use volunteers and we need more.
That's absolutely right. I mean, when we talked with fire chiefs, they told us they were recruiting virtually all the time. One fire chief said to us, he recruits when he goes to the supermarket. He, recruits in libraries and high schools and churches and synagogues, basically everywhere he goes. So you just have to be very, very active at getting the word out that this is a job that needs to be done. As your fire chief said, there are lots of different ways to do it. It's not always, putting on the fire gear and going into a fire or actually answering, going into the medical calls. There are all sorts of ways to volunteer.
Well, we heard from a lot of people on the Ideas Network Facebook page, and you can still join in at 800-642-1234 if you have thoughts or experiences when it comes to volunteer firefighting. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Dave on Facebook said he was a paid on-call firefighter EMT for 25 years before leaving almost a decade ago. He said there's a lot of reasons for the decline, some that you've mentioned, Catherine. He says, including there's more training required, people have more demands on their time from work and family, there may be less of a sense of community. Let's get into that first reason, the training requirement. Somebody else on Facebook talked about that as well. What kind of training goes into being a volunteer firefighter?
There are huge amounts of training required, and I know that Pennsylvania was looking at just the possibility of, are there ways to reduce the training hours, because not everybody needs to be trained in everything. But that's certainly a factor. There are hundreds of hours of training that goes into this. So yeah, it's a commitment. The equipment that you need is equipment. And many places will provide the equipment for themselves to the volunteers. In some places, the volunteers have to pay for it themselves. So that's a lot to ask some people.
Oh, so is that one of the solutions people are looking at? Okay, maybe we can alleviate some of the costs for volunteers who would have to otherwise buy their own equipment?
Yeah, that's absolutely one of the things that people are looking at. Because, you know, you want to make it appealing, and you want to kind of open the door to more people doing it.
And we heard also from John on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who says he went to volunteer in a small town, but they made him feel unwanted. Is that a concern that, you mentioned trying to reach out to more diverse crowds, but is there a concern that, okay, this is a group of people with long-time roots in the town, and maybe they're not as inviting as they could be to that new person?
You know, one of the people that we talked to was a professor in North Carolina who has studied volunteerism generally, and the biggest problem in general with volunteers is that they are, you know, sometimes poorly managed. So places really have to think about the way they're treating their volunteers and whether they are welcoming, whether the culture of the firehouse is one that accepts all kinds of different people, and, you know, that somebody who enters doesn't feel awkward or unwelcome. So that really is a big thing.
And we heard from Nate Melby here in Wisconsin earlier, Catherine. He and his colleagues with the Fire Chiefs Association are looking for more state support to help deal with some of these problems. Are you seeing that in the other states you covered where it's growing beyond just, okay, what does my individual community do about this versus, okay, hey, state, we need some help here?
Yes, small communities absolutely need help from their states. I mean, they can't support they can't come up with the funds to support, you know, a paid fire force. And the states really need to make the commitment. A lot of the states that we saw that were doing a more successful job, like Maryland, had, you know, put in the money to support their local communities, and that's what Pennsylvania is thinking of doing as well. This is a problem, though, all over the country, and as always, states vary a lot in how they handle different issues.
As we start to wrap up, Catherine, are you seeing pessimism? Are people really worried that, hey, this is the end of the line in a lot of communities for the volunteer firefighting?
I think that it is a shock to many communities, but the optimistic note that I found as I was doing the story was that there were ways to handle this. There's no magic bullet, but if you recruit very actively, if you open up the culture of the firehouse, if you offer incentives, it absolutely helps. And I think there's almost an inevitable increase that will continue in paid firefighters, and I'm not sure that you can completely stop the decline in volunteers, but you can certainly stem it.
We'll leave it there for now. Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Catherine Barrett, columnist and correspondent for Governing Magazine. We talked with her about the decline in the number of volunteer firefighters around the U.S. and what's being done to reverse those trends. We also talked to Nate Melby, president of the Wisconsin State Fire Chiefs Association and the volunteer chief of the Town of Campbell Fire Department. Well, there is still time for you to share your thoughts and your experiences maybe working with a volunteer fire department. You can share your thoughts over at the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, education funding is one of the key pieces of this year's ongoing budget negotiations here in the state. Lawmakers from both sides of the aisle will join us to share their perspectives, and you can weigh in, too, with what you want to see from the state and what you're seeing with your local district. An economic researcher looks at the state of the middle class in America, and the smoking age in the U.S. would go up to 21 under a plan from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. We'll find out why some tobacco researchers are worried about that proposal. That and more, all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7, Kate's guest says Americans are ignoring the reality of climate change and how it's likely to change our lives. Meet the author of the book, We're Doomed. Now what? That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll meet a therapist who went into therapy herself after a big life setback. She tells us what she learned about our common humanity along the way and shares some of the inside story of what goes on in therapy. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.